Psalm 10 is our text today. Psalm 10. And I'd like to speak to you based on this text on the triumph over terrorism. We think about that often in our world today. The triumph over terrorism. How the eternal King will do justice. Psalm 10. On March 17th, the United States State Department finally agreed to call the Islamic States, or what we sometimes call ISIS, their destruction of Christians, Yazidis, and others, genocide. Officially put that label on it on March 17th. Genocide. Of course, that term genocide just means the destruction of a particular kind, a genos. Intentionally targeting a particular kind of person for elimination. Genocide. One report on the situation which was presented to the State Department that I actually looked over included 24 pages of first-hand statements from Iraqi Christians, lists over 1,131 Iraqi Christians who have been killed in Iraq, documents over 200 attacks on the Christian community in Iraq, Syria, and in North Africa, along with 125 instances of churches being attacked in Iraq from 2003 to 2014. Perhaps you've seen snippets of this kind of thing broadcast on the internet or the news. And we're always horrified to hear of that kind of brutality. But when we look at that, what we're really seeing is the true face of this world system with the mask pulled off a little bit. The mask of respectability. The same arrogant spirit of taking human life that is evident in terrorism comes out in all the ways that human society, in all kinds of ways in human society, in human history. Let's bring it a little closer to home. The eugenics movement that was so prevalent in the United States of America in the early part of the 20th century. 1907, Indiana being the first state to enact into law forced sterilizations of people deemed to be not so desirable. And many states, the United States, followed suit to the point where, from what I understand, about 36,000 people in the United States were forcibly sterilized. Until the Nazis gave eugenics a bad name, and so we decided that those laws had to go in the 1940s. But the Nazis could say, and they did, hey, you guys did it first. Which is why in the war crimes tribunals that took place after World War II, they were not prosecuted on those points. Now, we never mass eliminated undesirables like they did, and therefore we can be, by God's grace, thankful for that. But it wasn't as if the same spirit wasn't at work here. And of course, the eugenics movement fed very well into the abortion movement. Margaret Sanger, what was the whole thrust of her argument for abortion? We need to eliminate these undesirables who are contaminating society. We need to get rid of them. And you know, they drag down society. We have to spend, they're a burden on the state. They're a problem in all these ways. We need to abort them. Abortion and now even euthanasia in our day are violent attacks on the most helpless people, those in the womb and those elderly and aged and infirm. Wars of aggression, the slave trade, sex trafficking. I mean, these are some of the most blatant forms of using and destroying other people for personal gain. This is the spirit of the world system and the God of this world who is a liar and a destroyer. And this spirit moves all the way down. We think of it on state action levels, but it moves all the way down to individual level and all sorts of abuses and manipulations of those who are weak and poor. And Psalm 10 deals with this. This is exactly the kind of situation that Psalm 10 deals with. Now, before we move into the text, it's important to remember because there's been a few weeks gap in our series of sermons here since we talked about Psalm 9, that Psalm 9 and 10 actually go together very, very closely. In fact, in some ways, we see the literary artistry of Scripture in these two psalms. Psalm 9 is a rough acrostic in that it takes the letters of the Hebrew alphabet and works through them in the poetry, all the way up through the letter in the Hebrew alphabet, Kaf or Kaf. And then Psalm 10 intentionally starts out with the next letter in the alphabet, Lamed, El, we would call it. And to show, in a sense, it's picking up off of what's been said already. Now, it breaks off in the psalm, but then at the very end of the psalm, verses 12 through the end, it reverts back to that alphabetic acrostic and finishes out the alphabet with the last few letters. And so you see how this was very intentional as David was writing this under the inspiration of the Spirit to draw this together in our minds. We shouldn't forget what Psalm 9 has been saying when we move into Psalm 10. Pardon me. And yet Psalm 10 does stand on its own as focusing on this question that's brought to our attention right at the beginning. Why, O Lord, do you stand afar off? Why do you hide yourself in times of trouble? Here's the problem that presents this psalm. You look at the world, and you see the trouble that it's involved in, and we see in particular the proud oppression of the wicked, and God seems absent. He's afar off. The hymn we just sang, Abide With Me, is in some ways the same kind of a prayer as Psalm 10 is. It's saying, God, don't be far away. The first stanza of Abide With Me talks about God being the help of the helpless. And we'll see that come out here in Psalm 10. This is the problem that presents itself as we move into the psalm. And let's remember this as we move into Psalm 10. The psalms shape our souls to seek first the kingdom of God and His righteousness. They call us to be, as it starts off with Psalm 1, that righteous man who pursues after the fellowship of God, drawing his life from God like a tree draws from streams of water as he abides in His word. The psalms call us to take refuge in the Son. The Son is God's anointed king who rules all the earth. And instead of rebelling against Him like the nations do, we take refuge in Him, Psalm 2. And that set the context for all the psalms we're going through. They call us to take refuge in God's anointed King, Jesus Christ our Lord. They really do show us more of Jesus Christ. They show us more of who He is and more of what it means for us to trust Him in the actual experience of life, in the realities of the difficulties of this world. And in doing that, they confront us with the realities of what this world is really like. We see that come out in Psalm 10. Don't miss this point. The Psalms confront us. They will not let us get away from how bad the world really is, actually. They keep going back to this. My thoughts today in this sermon are actually spring off of a perceptive comment by the Old Testament scholar Derek Kidner when he said this about Psalm 10. Meanwhile, God stands afar off, and the tyrant is doing nicely, as he would say. It is a function of the Psalms, and here's what caught my attention. It is a function of the Psalms to touch the nerve of this problem, and here's what's so interesting about this, to keep its pain alive against the comfort of our familiarity, or indeed complicity, with a corrupt world. The Psalms will not let us forget the tension of living in this corrupt world, lest we should become comfortable in it, lest we should even become complicit with it. So we ask ourselves as we move into Psalm 10, is the world really the way this psalm describes it? Because you might think as you initially read, or perhaps you've even had this thought as you've read through some of these psalms, I don't really know how I would sing this. I mean, is that really my experience? I mean, I don't seem to have enemies like lions and dogs eating me up all the time, and life is pretty good, actually. I'm not really sure how to sing this psalm and mean it for me. Maybe it's just for somebody else, someplace else. Well, does Psalm 10 really apply to us? One of the blessings, actually, maybe I should rephrase that. Maybe one of the startling effects of 9/11 here in our country was to wake us up to the fact that terrorism can happen right here as a nation. It startled us. But if we were well trained in the scriptures and in the Psalms, we would have seen that this spirit of the world system is always at work everywhere, including in our lives today. When we feel comfortable, you know, and our eyes get heavy and our heads kind of get to nod, and we get drowsy instead of being spiritually alert, well, what I want to do is let Psalm 10 alert you today to the realities of the world in which you live. Not to alarm you, but to let it drive you to put your trust in the Lord's eternal reign of justice, as that's been expressed in Jesus Christ and not in this world system. Let's just begin by reading here all of Psalm 10. David begins verses 1 through 11 with talking about the proud oppression of the wicked. Why, O Lord, do you stand off, afar off? Why do you hide? Literally, why do you hide in time of trouble? God does not seem to be there. He doesn't seem to be watching. He doesn't seem to be present. In arrogance, the wicked hotly pursue the poor. Let them be caught in the schemes that they have devised. For the wicked boasts of the desires of his soul, and the one greedy for gain curses and renounces the Lord. Or if you have a footnote there in your ESV, I believe, and even probably a better translation, is that he blesses the one who is greedy for gain and curses the Lord. Excuse me, renounces the Lord. That's the idea of this wicked man here. He's favorable toward the one who is greedy, but he renounces the Lord. In the pride of his face, the wicked does not seek him, does not seek the Lord. All his thoughts are, there is no God. He's a practical atheist, as far as that's concerned. His ways prosper at all times. Your judgments are on high, out of his sight. As for all his foes, he puffs at them. He says in his heart, I shall not be moved. Throughout all generations, I shall not meet adversity. His mouth is filled with cursing and deceit and oppression. Under his tongue are mischief and iniquity. He sits in ambush in the villages. In hiding places, he murders the innocent. His eyes stealthily watch for the helpless. He lurks in ambush like a lion in his thicket. He lurks that he may seize the poor. He seizes the poor when he draws him into his net. The helpless are crushed, sink down, and fall by his might. He says in his heart, God is forgotten. He has hidden his face. He will never see it. And so David then, in response to this description of the wicked, cries out to the Lord, a plea to God to arise. Arise, O Lord, O God, lift up your hand. Forget not the afflicted. Why does the wicked renounce God and say in his heart, you will not call to account? But you do see, for you note mischief and vexation, that you may take it into your hands. To you, the helpless commits himself. You have been the helper of the fatherless. Break the arm of the wicked and evildoer. Call his wickedness to account till you find none. And then it closes on this praise for the Lord's eternal reign of justice. The Lord is king forever and ever. The nations perish from his land. O Lord, you hear the desire of the afflicted. You will strengthen their heart. You will incline your ear to do justice to the fatherless and the oppressed, so that man who is of the earth may strike terror no more. Here's the triumph over terrorism. You see in verses 1 through 11, the proud oppression of the wicked. Now, if you remember, going back to Psalm 1, we've already met this wicked man. We talked about him a little bit, what he's like back there. They're the people who, yes, there are extreme forms of this wickedness, but if we were to boil it all down, they basically are just not believers. They're ungodly. They don't take God into account. They have no reverence for God. So they're those who act as though God did not really matter. I mean, we've already seen this in what we read here in Psalm 10, right? In the pride of his face, the wicked does not seek him. All his thoughts are, there is no God. Now we see even from verse, I think it's 11, he says in his heart, God is forgotten, he has hidden his face, he will never see it. It's not as much, so much that this wicked man is being described here is necessarily a hardened, convinced atheist who's philosophically thought out all his arguments and to his own mind has proved there is no such thing as God. It's more the case of, I really don't know and I really don't care. It doesn't matter to me. Because I really don't believe that God is going to bring my life into judgment. That's what it boils down to. Yeah, there may be some God out there, but as far as I'm concerned, he's not going to see. He's not going to know. And it's really not going to make any difference to my day-to-day life whether God exists or not. I can live the way I want to live. That's the kind of man he is. So he doesn't think about God. If we were to go back to Psalm 9, verse 17, it says, the wicked shall return to Sheol. All the nations that do what? That forget God. Forget about God. That's not a controlling interest in his life. They don't think about God. They have no concern for God's ways. And so they do what they want to do. And that's what it boils down to. I do what I want to do. Whatever I think is best for me, that's what I'm going to do. That's the wicked man that's being described here. And so that can take forms from what we might think of as small forms of evil all the way up to genocide. One interesting thing I noticed as I was studying this psalm this week is if we just compare even things like Psalm 10, verse 6, where it says, he says in his heart, I shall not be moved throughout all generations. I shall not meet adversity, with the description of the whore Babylon in Revelation 18. You see a lot of similarities. Why? Because this wicked man, he is embodying, he shares the characteristics of the world system. He lives for the God of this world. That's the way he acts. That's the way he thinks. That's the way he goes about his business and his life. Now, lest we think that that's just somebody out there somewhere and, you know, we couldn't possibly be that wicked sort of man. Just think about the universality of the characteristics described of these wicked people here. And then all you have to do, in fact, is go watch maybe a nursery for a while or somewhere where there's little kids. I've seen this in my household. In fact, according to my mother, I was guilty of these sins a lot when I was that age. A bigger kid sees a little toddler, and not even a toddler, you know, someone's just learning to sit up and crawl, and he has something that the big kid wants. Oh, push you over, take the toy, go play. Hey, life is great. I just got what I wanted. He's over there screaming, but I don't care. Right? That's the wicked man. That's the way he acts toward other people. I'm out for myself here, really, is what it boils down to. And if I can get what I want, I will. So this isn't so unusual, is it really? It's the way we're born. We are naturally, by nature, this way. It's only by God's grace that we're rescued from this. We have this selfish pride that drives us. Now, in this psalm, the wicked are described, but also you see a tremendous contrast. I hope you noticed even as we read through. There are actually seven terms in Psalms 9 and 10 that describe the defenseless person. And what's so interesting about this is that in each case, in each one of these seven terms, it's the first time in all the book of Psalms they show up. But they're all clustered together right here. We have here the poor, needy person, Psalm 9, verse 18. The needy shall not always be forgotten. The hope of the poor shall not perish forever. We have the oppressed person, Psalm 9, 9. The Lord is a stronghold for the oppressed. It's used again in Psalm 10 and verse 18. So to do justice to the fatherless and the oppressed. We have here him described as also the a victim, or an unfortunate kind of person, we might call it. Just looked at chapter 10, verse 8. He sits in ambush in the villages. In the hiding places, he murders the innocent. His eyes stealthily watch for the helpless. That's the person described here with this one. The person who doesn't have the power to help himself, to defend himself against this person, the helpless one. He's also this defenseless person is also described here in these Psalms as the fatherless or an orphan. Verse 14, "But you do see, for you know mischief and vexation, that you may take it into your hands. To you the helpless commits himself. You have been the helper of the fatherless." Pardon me. Verse 18, as we already saw, "to do justice to the fatherless and the oppressed." Another synonym, a description of this person. He's also described as the innocent. Look back up at verse 8 again. "The wicked man sits in ambush in the villages. In hiding places, he murders the innocent. His eyes stealthily watch for the helpless." Pardon me. Also then described here as somebody who's weak. Weak or even wretched, we might sometimes translate it. Go back up to Psalm 10:2. "In arrogance, the wicked hotly pursue the poor. Let them be caught in the schemes that they have devised." This translation of poor is somebody who is very weak. He doesn't have the power to defend himself. If we go on down to verse 9, we see this term used again. "He lurks in ambush like a lion in his thicket. He lurks that he may seize the poor. He seizes the poor when he draws him into his net." Pardon me. Also then, for really related, but another term, a helpless one. One who was very, sometimes we could translate this term actually even gentle, humble. But in this case, helpless. We've looked at it already. Look at verse 12. "Arise, O Lord, O God, lift up your hand. Forget not the afflicted." It's called here, afflicted. Or verse 17. "O Lord, you hear the desire of the afflicted." So there's this very rich description of a defenseless, poor, helpless, afflicted, needy person in contrast with the wicked. And that reveals to us that one of the major concerns of David in this psalm and the Holy Spirit in this psalm is this oppression of these weak people by the wicked man. The man of the earth is described in chapter 10, verse 18. The man of the earth, the one who denies the existence of God and so acts in that way. He forsakes his divinely appointed role of being a steward of the earth and instead engages in consuming, taking, getting, whatever I can get from other people. Now, that's what this psalm is describing. Here, and especially in these first 11 verses, is where the focus is, the proud oppression of the wicked. How is that happening today in the USA? I mean, does this really connect with our experience? Should we be seeing this today? Should our eyes be open to this in our prayers and our spiritual life? I believe very much so, yes. Let me just bring out one example here, and I'm going to try to play this out so we can see a little bit of how this is working in our society. The German author Gabriel Kubi argues that the goal of the sexual revolution in Western civilization is to remake mankind. And here's what she says. "Modern and postmodern man have emancipated themselves from God, from nature, from the family, from tradition, woman from man, children from parents, and individuals from themselves as man and woman. They stand naked, restrained by nothing and defined by nothing other than their own wishes, desires, and drives." By the way, think about verse 3 of the text we just read. "The wicked boasts of the desires of his soul. What I want is what's going to define me." Right? She's saying that's how Western man is. Restrained by nothing and defined by nothing other than their own wishes, desires, and drives. But she goes on to make this observation. "They think they are free to self-actualize and do not notice that in their vulnerability and lack of inhibitions, they are more malleable than ever before. The strong can use the weak for their own purposes without the uprooted, manipulated person noticing it in time." I believe she's actually very perceptive in that. Because what she's noticing is the end of every attempt to destroy the family as God designed it ends in slavery. In the name of individual liberty, we are brought to slavery. So when it comes to family life, one of the real achievements of Christianity in the West was to provide the ordered liberty through the faithful bonds of matrimony. And if you studied history, you'll recognize, and the history of human relations in the family, you'll recognize this was a revolution brought about by Christianity in the Roman world. But now we're seeing that go the other direction in our lifetimes, in our day. Of course, sinful man has always fought against this God's ordered liberty in the family in various ways. We've always been sinners. But I think in the modern era, there began a systematic undermining of this kind of liberty by undermining the human person as the image of God, male and female. Here's how that started. Liberty became detached from God, connected to myself, my rights, my autonomy. Is how I'm going to establish who I am. And begin to see this play out in various thinkers. And the reason philosophers are helpful folks is not because they're always right, but sometimes they're kind of like weather vanes on a society. They put into words, you know, they're the ones who think a lot and put into words what a lot of people are thinking and feeling and believing. So we come into English history with somebody like John Stuart Mill, an English philosopher. Think early part of the 19th century. And he'd argue for no-fault divorce. If we're going to have liberty and freedom, freedom of women, then there needs to be no-fault divorce. We also need to make sure that women aren't tied to a family economy, like having to depend upon a husband's wages and things like that. Because that's a diminution of their personal capacity and their freedom and things like this. And so we need to, and obviously if you're going to do that kind of thing, well, you've got to loosen up the sexual boundaries a little bit. You know, our society is a little bit repressive when it comes to those things. We're a little bit over the top on all this, you know, castigating people who aren't faithful in marriage and things like that. We need to open up those boundaries, allow for no-fault divorce. Mill began to argue things like this. You think of Marx, Karl Marx, and Friedrich Engels, his collaborator. 1840s, 50s, and so on here. Began to argue from the basis of their philosophy of materialism, dialectical materialism, that really believed that humans, what humans are is determined by their material environment. Began to argue for, of course, what we now call communism and that whole philosophy, that way of life. But it was crucial in their philosophy that we take apart the family as what we call, as Christians, the family as God designed it. We can't have that sort of thing because that resists, that's actually aiding and abetting this bourgeois family that's so stuck in our current conditions, and we have to change that. So we need to make sure, one of the big steps the Engels in particular articulated was we've got to get women out of the home. We've got to have them full employment elsewhere because it can't be centered around the family anymore. The state needs to take care of all these things in order to advance our agenda, especially children. We can't have them trained at home either. We could go on and on through different thinkers and talk about different things, Freud and different ones, and how this started to play out itself as a more systematic attack and undermining on the very who we are as people and how that plays out in our family relationships. But let me just bring you to one feminist, Simone Beauvoir, who said this, and I just select this quote out of things she said because it kind of encapsulates so much of this intentional thinking and their worldview and what they were after in doing this. In the name of liberty. A world where men and women would be equal is easy to visualize, So what's the objective here? We've got to make men and women equal, because that's how you're free, right? It's easy to visualize, for that is precisely what the Soviet Revolution promised. Now, she would say it didn't fulfill that, but it promised that. The Soviet Revolution of the 1917 and forward there. Women raised and trained exactly like men to work under the same conditions for the same wages. Erotic liberty was to be recognized by custom. Free to do whatever you want sexually. That's okay. We have to stipulate that. This has to be recognized. Woman was to be obliged to provide for herself with other ways of earning a living. In other words, we'll actually require women to not depend upon a man, because that, you know, this whole arrangement where, men work and women raise children, that's so oppressive, and we've got to change that. So we're going to require women to work elsewhere, not be dependent on a man. We can't have that and still have liberty. Marriage was to be based upon a free agreement that the spouses could break at will. Maternity was to be voluntary, which meant that contraception and abortion were to be authorized. Okay, not just allowed, but authorized. We have to have this if we're going to achieve our goals here of freedom. There must be contraception, because otherwise, you know, I wouldn't want to be involuntarily saddled with having to take care of a child. Abortion, same reason. Which meant that contraception and abortion were to be authorized, and that, on the other hand, all mothers and their children were to have exactly the same rights in or out of marriage. Marriage doesn't make any difference to anything. Pregnancy leaves were to be paid for by the state, which would assume charge of the children. Signifying, she says, not that they would be taken away from their parents, but that they would not be abandoned to them. We wouldn't want the state to abandon poor children to the care of their parents. The state has to intervene so that they're not left with those poor parents who might do things that we know wouldn't be good for the child. This is the feminist view of the world. It really goes back to an agenda. We've got to eliminate sexual differences in order to achieve our utopia. But by the way, this wasn't just this kind of a philosophy wasn't just limited to what we would think of as the political left. Sometimes those on the right, some of you who studied economics might recognize the name of Friedrich Hayek, who thought in similar ways when it came to the family. Why? This is individualism. It's it's free choice. We've got to be able to make the choices we want for ourselves. And so, we have the whole contraceptive revolution, trying to, first of all, divorce in Western civilization marriage from reproduction. Right? Marriage has nothing to do with having children. It's for personal fulfillment. That's why you get married. Right? And so we need to come up with a good way that you can get married and have that personal fulfillment without having to really worry about children unless you want to. So we'll come up with very effective contraceptive measures, which is the drive behind the pill. Let's make sure this can work so that you can enjoy whatever you want, but not have to be, you know, have a child unless you want one. Contraception. Divorcing marriage from reproduction. That's not really part of the picture anymore. Then no-fault divorce. Pardon me. We see it playing out in the United States shortly thereafter in the 1970s, after contraception became widespread in the 60s, no-fault divorce coming in the 70s. Because after all, if you're going to be free, you've got to be able to, as Beauvoir put it, break the marriage at will. It doesn't fulfill me anymore, so I can choose something else. There's no meaning and there's no purpose here. There's not anything we were called to be. And that, of course, even leading on to today where we're at now, having arguments about so-called same-sex marriage, which the more honest adherents of it are really saying is not about marriage at all. It's about destroying what we think of as marriage. Now, here's what begins to happen. What really happens when we seek freedom in this way? Actually, the author I cited, Kubi, already said it. She said, "They think they are free to self-actualize and do not notice that in their vulnerability and lack of inhibitions, they are more malleable than ever before. The strong can use the weak for their own purposes without the uprooted, manipulated person noticing it in time." That is actually what really does happen in this kind of a scenario. You break all family ties, and we could read sociologists who have described this over the course of the 20th century in America. You break deep-rootedness in who we are in these family connections, and you leave people alone, vulnerable. Eliminate all intermediary institutions except them and the state. Now, whose power does that enhance? The state. But they don't have to come at you saying, they don't have to come at you as a terrorist saying, "Hey, do what we say or we'll destroy you, we'll slit your throat." They just have to say, "Hey, we'll provide for you. Everything you need, come here. Right here. We'll pay for it." You get in that situation, and then try not to do what the state says to do. How do you do that? You're effectively reduced to powerlessness at that point. The person, and we can see this over and over play out in such sad ways. Say in communities where fatherlessness is widespread, where there are generations of broken family units with no intact marriages and fathers in the home training up children. And what are the kind of sometimes even pathological problems we start to see develop in these kind of communities? Those are exactly the people that are the easiest to prey upon by the strong. Somebody that has the position of power, somebody that has, they become pawns in their game. They use them for their purposes. You remember even back at the founding of the United States, and we could go on talking about this for a long time. I'll try not to be too long here with all these. We could come up with illustration after illustration. But at the founding of the United States, it was common for states, when they were first formed from colonies into states, to institute voting requirements that required somebody to be a landowner in order to vote. Now, whether we agree with that or not, it might be a great thing. That's beside my point today. It is instructive to think about why they made that rule. It was because they knew that people who have their own means of subsistence have a reason to defend that against people in power who will say, "I'll give you this, I'll do this for you." They would say, "No, thank you, I have my own place." Versus people who don't have anything, and someone comes along saying, "Hey, I'll get this for you. I'm in a position of power to get what you need, what you want," and start developing a whole politics of envy. See what that guy has? You need that too. It's your right to have it. Put me in power and I'll get it for you. Now, that sounds altruistic, but what it is this person in power using those people without power for his own ends. Give me the vote, give me whatever it is, and I'll do what you want. I'll give you something you want. This is what starts to happen more and more and more. So this is why it becomes troubling that we have, for example, today in our society, such a huge number of people living off of state-provided funds. What can start well-meaning actually very easily turns into a manipulation. You see, it's really not surprising. I already started to merge into an economic realm there, but let's come back to just the family realm that I was talking about earlier. It's not surprising at all that the sodomite agenda should seek to become the law of the land. It's really not surprising because the spirit of the movement is genocide, the destruction of a particular kind of person. that is distinctively male and female with nothing else. And it does it in the name of freedom. We have to be free to follow our desires. The wicked boasts of the desires of his soul. This is what I want, and I'm going to pursue it. And if I have to crush other people in the process, oh well. This is what I want. Now, we could come at this from the financial angle, which, I, like I said, I already started to merge into a little bit there. That's the attempt to reduce people to a resource to be exploited for financial gain. And this has happened so frequently throughout human history. We could talk about virtually every year that humans have been in existence and give examples of this kind of a thing. And we'll have an opportunity to talk about that more later on as we go through the psalm, so I'm just going to set that aside today. Stay tuned. But in the end, what the psalmist prays is truly what happens. He prays in Psalm 10:2, "In arrogance the wicked hotly pursue the poor. Let them be caught in the schemes that they have devised." We end up destroying ourselves with all of our schemes to advance our power at the expense of other people. We're caught in the schemes that we devise. Pardon me. How does that happen, though? Well, let's go down to, that's a good segue to the next section of the psalm, verses 12 through 15, a plea for the Lord to call to account. "Arise, O Lord, O God, lift up your hand, forget not the afflicted." So we have this situation where the man desiring his own pleasure, his own desires, pursuing those at the expense of other people, using people, whoever he can, to advance his own agenda against people who can't resist him. Who don't have, whether it's the financial means or the relational means or the social means or whatever it is, even the spiritual reserves, to resist him. The psalmist prays, "God, you act. Forget not the afflicted." Why does the wicked renounce God and say in his heart, "You will not call to account"? That's not true. You do see. You note mischief and vexation, that you may take it into your hands. To you the helpless commits himself. You have been the helper of the fatherless. Even the fatherless. Even the one who's deprived of those social relations that by God's design should give a person more strength. I talked about how that person who's alone is the most malleable, the most vulnerable, the most easily to be manipulated for the strong's gain. Well, that's the paradigm case of that in the Old Testament is the fatherless person. He doesn't have that example, that protector, that defender, that provider. He doesn't have those relational ties. I mean, folks, this is just common sense, and you can even read sociologists this very day. Go do research. Who does better in life? Young people with intact families and fathers in the home, or those who don't have them? I mean, it's just a no-brainer. People try to deny it sometimes, but it's an obvious fact of human existence. And that's why it becomes, in the Old Testament, this paradigm case of the needy person who's vulnerable to the strong, taking advantage of him, manipulating him when he doesn't know any better even. "You have been the helper of the fatherless." So God, he says here, "break the arm of the wicked." Snap his arm in two. What's the picture, of course? Make him powerless. This is his power. You take away his power. "Call his wickedness to account until you find none." He's asking for true justice. And so where does he look for hope in that? And here's a key thing for us as believers. He turns in verses 16 through 18 to praise that the eternal king will do justice. The Lord will triumph over terrorism. The Lord is king forever and ever. Okay, here's the problem that I started with, the perspective of the psalm. Why are you so far away? It doesn't seem like you're really acting as a king. But you are a king. I know that. And I know you're a king forever and ever. And I know that the nations will perish from your land. Why? Because you hear the desire of the afflicted. And notice a total contrast of desire here. Same term, by the way. But the wicked boasts of the desire of his soul. But here's a desire of the afflicted that's lifted up to the Lord. The wicked says, "I will accomplish what I want." The afflicted says, "Oh Lord, you accomplish your good will." Your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. The Lord will strengthen their heart. You will incline your ear to do justice. You will vindicate the fatherless and the oppressed, so that man who is of the earth may strike terror no more. And I need to move through this quickly, but I want you to put the connections together in your mind to see how God is working in the world today. Folks, this is what God has done and is doing and will bring to completion in Jesus Christ our Lord. I believe that this man who is of the earth that's referenced here, and by the way, the term, if you remember back to Psalm 9, we use that term enosh, of man, a mortal, frail, weak man. Man who is of the earth may strike terror no more. I believe this man who is of the earth in Psalm 10:18 is reflected in the theme in the book of Revelation of those who dwell upon the earth dwellers. Revelation 3:10, 8:13, 11:10, 13:8, 14, 17:8, we can go on. But just, we won't take time to look at those here today. These earth dwellers in Revelation are those who follow the beast, who oppose and kill the saints. And so they are the wrath of, they are the objects of the wrath of God. What we have here is a case of mortal men versus the eternal king. Earthly tyrants versus the God of heaven. And God will bring about his victories. You know, living in our time as opposed to David, as he is writing this psalm, we can see something of the outworking of God's plan that David could only foresee. The life and death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. We can see how God has acted in history to deal with this problem of the wicked and the oppression of the righteous. His resurrection of Jesus Christ was his vindication of everyone who is in Christ. Don't ever lose sight of that fact. When the world puts pressure and seeks to extort conformity to its agenda and its desires, remember that God has vindicated you in Jesus Christ. When he raised him from the dead, he said, "This is my beloved. This you are in him. You are right and right with me in him. And I will act to show that." He has appointed a day in which he will judge the world in righteousness by this man that he has ordained, Paul preached to the Athenians. Jesus Christ. He proved that by raising him from the dead. Now, that's going to come to fruition when Jesus Christ comes again as the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. With a sharp sword out of his mouth, he will judge the living and the dead. Keep your eyes upon that. That's exactly what Psalm 10 drives us to. You know, it does us a couple favors. Some very good work in our souls that Psalm 10 does for us. One, if you're comfortable here on this earth before the time of Christ's kingdom, and you need a good dose of these psalms to wake you up to see what's really going on in world history. We can start to feel comfortable. I have a pretty good life here in the U.S. of A. Praise God for it. You know, every good thing that you enjoy, praise God for that. But don't let that make you drowsy. Why is it that our spirits get drowsy when God takes care of us? I don't know, but it is our tendency. Don't get drowsy to see, well, this must not really be happening. I can't see it. The wicked oppressing, the wicked, you know, trying to set an ambush and murder innocent people. And no, folks, this is the true nature of the world. And don't ever forget it, or you will become complacent. You will start to think, oh, I can kind of fit in with this world. You know, it's really not so bad. A lot of nice people here. And they don't seem to be out to murder me in my sleep. Don't forget, there is a God of this world, and he is pushing his agenda relentlessly. He's seeking conformity. He's winning hearts and minds. He's after you. And he doesn't have to do it at the point of a terrorist gun. I mean, he could do it that way. And if he can, he will. But if he can get you through the world system, through conforming your heart to his desires, he'll do it that way. Don't fall for the facade that the world system puts up. It wants to look good, respectable, noble. Terrorism is just the mask getting torn off. The God of this world is out to devour and to destroy, not to give life, and he will use every means possible to deceive you into being complacent and then complicit with his idolatry. Pray Psalm 10. Pray it for yourself. Pray it for your family. Sing it like you mean it, because this will keep you alert. This will say, this is really what's going on today. God, you've got to arise on our behalf and save us. But then, when you're alert to the danger, trust in the Lord's eternal reign of justice. Sometimes, when God mercifully awakens us to the real danger that is there, it can be overwhelming. It'd be like, how do I even begin to stand against this? There's no way. I'm helpless. I'm powerless. What am I going to do? You know, am I going to stand up against the United Nations and the United States government and everybody else in the whole world? And I can't do this. What does it drive us to here? The Lord is King forever and ever. Okay, he will execute justice for those who trust in him, those who take refuge in him. He has not abandoned you. He will deliver. He will save. And that brings it back to the question for your heart today. Do you trust him? Do you trust him so much that you won't conform to this world? That you won't buy into its lies? No matter how overwhelming it seems to, as they would say it, stand on the wrong side of history. I mean, this is just the way history is going. You benighted people out there won't get on with the program. And if you won't, you'll just have to get out of the way. No matter how overwhelming it seems, you know the end. You know what really is true. And how has God proved it? He sent his son Jesus to rescue us, to redeem us. And he vindicated him and us in him by raising him from the dead. We're a week out from our Easter celebrations. But don't start forgetting what that means. That means everything to us. It's life. Man of the earth may strike terror no more. Here's triumph over terrorism. It's Jesus' resurrection from the dead. And we can live in that. We can rest in that. Even if terrorism comes right to us, as it already is. Trust in the Lord.